Hi, everybody. It's Derek, and this is your Foreign Exchanges World News Roundup for Saturday, March 16th and Sunday, March 17th, 2024. Happy St. Patrick's Day to anybody who celebrated that today. I spent most of the day making Guinness stew, a lot longer than I thought I was going to spend making it. So this roundup may be a little bit more to the point than usual, but we could all use that on a holiday, I guess. Also, by way of a programming note, we are approaching our usual spring break week here at Foreign Exchanges. There's some additional meaning to that this year. People who have been around long enough to know, I've had some family upheavals over the last several months, or one big family upheaval in particular. For reasons related to that, I'm going to be taking a not just because I need the break, which I do, but also because of those family things, I'm going to be taking a break for the spring break week, as I usually do, but maybe a bit longer this time around. I'll be stepping away from the newsletter after Thursday's roundup. We will return to our regular schedule on Tuesday, April 2nd. So thanks for bearing with me. And thanks, as always, for reading the newsletter. Now, let's get into it. There's just a couple anniversaries this weekend. On March 16th, 1527, although outnumbered, an early Mughal army under the dynasty's founder, Babur, defeated a conglomeration of forces under Rajput leader Rana Sanga at the Battle of Kanwa in northeastern India. Babur made effective use of field artillery and wagon fortifications, something he learned from the Ottomans, as well as the defection of a large portion of Ragasanga's army to win the battle. In defeat, Ragasanga's alliance fell apart and Mughal control of northern India was secured until they were temporarily ousted from power in 1540. Don't worry, they came back. On March 17th, 1861, the first Italian parliament proclaimed King Victor Emmanuel II of Sardinia as king of a newly unified Italy. This was the culmination of a unification process, the Risorgimento, that began amid the revolutions of 1848, though the process wasn't completed until the Italians took Venice from Austria in 1866 and Rome from the papacy in 1870. On to the news. In the Middle East, we start, as usual these days, with Israel-Palestine. There is apparently some newfound optimism about the possibility of a ceasefire in Gaza, mostly because Hamas has reportedly softened its negotiating position. I'm not entirely clear how, but a number of outlets have suggested that the group is no longer pushing hard for a permanent ceasefire and an Israeli military IDF withdrawal from the territory, both of which were non-starters for the Israeli government. Hamas leaders, the story goes, are starting to realize that their hopes of a Ramadan uprising have fizzled, and they may be feeling some rising resentment from Gaza's civilian population as it continues to bear the brunt of the consequences for the October 7th attacks. Even a temporary ceasefire could help tamp down those feelings. A new round of negotiations was supposed to begin in Qatar on Sunday, but I haven't seen any reporting as to how it went. In other items, it hasn't been a great few days for Hamas, which may help explain the softening of its negotiating position. The Israeli military now believes it has confirmed that Marwan Issa, deputy commander of Hamas's Qassam Brigades, was indeed killed in an IDF airstrike last weekend. Hamas officials were also displeased with the Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas's decision to name Mohammed Mustafa as the PA's new prime minister on Thursday, criticizing the unilateral appointment. The PA's ruling Fatah party clapped back, pointing out that Hamas had acted pretty unilaterally itself on October 7th, and that might have stung a bit given how things are going at present. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu reiterated over the weekend that no matter how many Palestinian kids he kills and no matter how much facile criticism he takes for it from Israel's Western enablers, he's committed to an IDF assault on Rafah. In a press conference on Sunday alongside visiting German Chancellor Olaf Scholz, Netanyahu did stress that the IDF won't leave Rafah's civilian population, quote, locked in place, end quote, but will instead, quote, enable them to leave, end quote. Rhetorically, this seems a far cry from the actionable evacuation plan the Biden administration says it has demanded, and even from the nebulous humanitarian islands idea that the IDF floated a few days ago, but maybe I'm reading too much into what Netanyahu is quoted as saying. The Washington Post published a report on Saturday looking at one of the more inscrutable aspects of the situation in Gaza, the thousands of people who are currently classified as missing. It's impossible to know how many of them are genuinely missing as opposed to those who are actually dead but whose bodies haven't been recovered, or those who have been seized by the IDF without notification. At this point, many of the undiscovered dead might never be identified. Of those who have been confirmed dead, with the official toll now approaching 32,000, the United Nations says that more than 13,000 have been children. That number will, of course, continue to increase because of the violence, but also more and more because of starvation. I really don't have a point to make here other than to note once more that while children in Gaza are being starved to death right now because of a blockade that's being enabled by U.S. military support, the only solution the Biden administration has offered, absent a ceasefire, is an overcomplicated emergency seaport scheme that might, in the best case scenario, be able to start accepting aid shipments 2 months from now. Moving on to Syria, a landmine killed at least 19 civilians who were hunting truffles in eastern Syria's Raqqa province on Saturday, according to the Syrian Observatory for Human Rights. The explosive was almost certainly planted by Islamic State at some point, though there's no way to know that for certain, nor is there any way to know how long it had been there. IS fighters do frequently attack truffle hunting parties, but whether they intentionally targeted this one is impossible to say. On Sunday morning, an apparent Israeli missile strike hit targets near Damascus, wounding at least one Syrian soldier. The Syrian Observatory claimed that the strike targeted a Hezbollah weapons shipment. Moving on to Asia and Pakistan, where armed attackers, including a number of suicide bombers, struck a military base in northern Pakistan's Khyber Pakhtunkhwa province on Saturday, killing at least seven security personnel. At least six of the attackers also died during the battle. A group calling itself Jaish-e-Fursan-e-Mohammed claimed responsibility for the attack. In North Korea, the North Korean military carried out some sort of weapons launch on Monday, firing what appears to have been at least one ballistic missile off the country's east coast, according to both the South Korean and Japanese militaries. Japanese officials reported a second launch, so there may have been actually two missiles involved. It's unclear what weapons were launched, but the South Korean government is hosting a Summit for Democracy conference starting on Monday, and one of the attendees happens to be U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken. Presumably, the North Koreans seized the opportunity to make a bit of a statement. In Africa, in Niger, that country's ruling junta announced on Saturday that it is withdrawing from a military cooperation agreement with the United States, quote unquote, with immediate effect, according to Reuters. The U.S. government sent a delegation of some sort to Niger earlier this week that apparently offended the junta somehow, as it cited some unspecified breach of diplomatic protocol in announcing the end of the military arrangement. The way U.S. officials have described the trip, it sounds like it might have included some uncomfortable discussions about the junta's plans or lack thereof for transitioning Niger back to some semblance of civilian rule, and or, and this may be more likely, about the junta's relationship with Russia. The implications for the U.S. military could be significant, given that Niger was U.S. Africa Command's primary operational hub in West Africa. That said, the Pentagon began consolidating U.S. operations in Niger after the coup in July and has already been talking to governments in coastal West African states about setting up new bases, so it wasn't entirely unprepared for something like this. In Nigeria, at least 16 soldiers attempting to quell a violent land dispute were attacked and killed in southern Nigeria's Delta State on Thursday. They were responding to clashes between the Okoloba and Okuama communities when, according to the Nigerian military, they, quote, were surrounded by some community youths and killed, end quote. Nigerian authorities say they've made arrests in the case and are continuing to investigate. In Somalia, the Indian Navy reported on Saturday that its personnel had seized the MV Ruin, a cargo vessel that Somali pirates hijacked back in December. Indian officials say their personnel forced the surrender of some 35 hijackers and rescued 17 crew members. This is the first recovery of a vessel taken by Somali pirates since 2017, which admittedly might have something to do with the fact that Somali piracy had been on the decline until a few months ago. On to Europe. In Russia, Vladimir Putin has, and I hope you're sitting down because this one is a real shocker, won Russia's presidential election. Though the odds were stacked against him, the two-term incumbent eked out a narrow win with, at last check, a bit over 88% of the vote. It was a close race between Putin and his main challenger, some other guy. But in the end, the very real votes of actual Russians in this completely free and fair election carried the day. Official turnout, also a definitely real and meticulously counted figure, was around 74%. The Ukrainian military marked Putin's triumph with a series of drone strikes over the weekend, killing at least two people in Belgorod Oblast, and one of them, primarily they targeted, as they've been doing for some time now, Russian oil facilities. One attack caused a fire at a Rosneft refinery in Samara Oblast on Saturday, while an overnight strike reportedly caused a fire at a refinery in Krasnodar Oblast. Russian authorities also accused the Ukrainians of targeting civilian electrical infrastructure. In Moldova, authorities in that country's breakaway Transnistria region accused the Ukrainian military of having attacked one of their military bases with a drone on Sunday. The Moldovan government later said it couldn't confirm that any attack had taken place, while the Ukrainian government rejected the charge and accused Transnistria and its Russian ally of, quote, trying to carry out provocations and manipulate the information space by spreading fakes, end quote. In the Americas, in Colombia, that country's government announced on Sunday that it is suspending its ceasefire with the ex-Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia, or FARC, faction Estado Mayor Central in three provinces, Nariño, Cauca, and Valle del Cauca. According to Colombian officials, EMC fighters have broken the ceasefire by attacking security forces and civilians in those three regions. As far as I know, there hasn't been any reaction yet from the EMC. Finally, in the United States, at dollars and cents, Nick French looks at the benefits that are accruing to U.S. companies as a result of the Israeli occupation of Palestinian land, particularly with respect to U.S. defense contractors. Let me read you a bit of his piece. The U.S. corporations with the most direct complicity in Israeli crimes, of course, are military contractors. According to Molly Gott and Derek Seidman, writing for the investigative news website Eyes on the Ties, five of the six biggest weapons manufacturers in the world are based in the United States. Those are Lockheed Martin, Northrop Grumman, Boeing, General Dynamics, and RTX, formerly known as Raytheon. Disturbingly, but unsurprisingly, many of these companies saw their stock prices shoot up when Israel's war on Gaza began, Gott and Seidman reported. And weapons company executives have been publicly enthusiastic about the opportunities for profit opened up by the war. Discussing the conflict on an earnings call on October 24th, RTX CEO Greg Hayes declared, quote, I think really across the entire Raytheon portfolio, you're going to see a benefit of this restocking, end quote. On General Dynamics' earnings call the following day, the company's CFO and Executive Vice President Jason Aiken said, quote, if you look at the incremental demand potential coming out of that, the biggest one to highlight, and that really sticks out, is probably on the artillery side, end quote. There can be little doubt that Israeli forces are using these weapons to commit war crimes against Palestinians. As Stephen Semler reported in Jacobin, many of the specific weapons that the Biden administration has sent to Israel have repeatedly been used to commit war crimes in the past. This includes Hellfire missiles, artillery shells, and assault rifles that have been used to kill clearly identified civilians. It also includes white phosphorus, which Semler describes as, quote, a brutal incendiary weapon capable of burning straight through flesh, bone, and even metal, end quote, that is outlawed for use near civilians by Protocol 3 of the Geneva Conventions. Israel has used white phosphorus repeatedly, including in the current war. There's more in there about other types of companies that benefit from the occupation, all in a wonderfully capitalist way. Good for those guys. On that note, that's all for us tonight. Thanks for all of you. Thanks to all of you for reading and or listening to the newsletter. Hope you had a great weekend. And I thank you, especially if you are a foreign exchange subscriber, because you guys make this newsletter possible. Until next time, take care, and I'll talk to you soon. Bye-bye.